If something happens to the Supreme Leader, there will be a North Korean nuclear strike on the United States. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Elliot, where have you migrated to since last we were together in Basin Harbor, Vermont?
Well, I'm in a secure location in another part of Vermont. We just concluded a terrific conference on the issue of net assessment, which is begins with the assessing of military balances, but goes in all kinds of directions. And it's, you know, it was very interesting in many ways. You gave the keynote talking about the great Andrew Marshall and both what he was like, but also how he really influenced and shaped a generation of people who think about strategy, but also a lot of people who who've been in a position to make decisions. And that was very interesting. One of the things I took away from the conference, actually, which we just finished, was the extent to which a lot of our allies are now opening up net assessment shops. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that, you know, it is a more and more dangerous world, and people don't feel that they can entirely trust us, or they can't entirely trust our assessments. Now, people have always, to some extent, mistrusted our assessments of things. But this is very different, and this is actually a very good thing. I mean, I really am a great believer in, you know, let 100 flowers bloom. But I thought it was indicative of something. We should probably, we can talk more about that. But I think we probably should move on to the jackasseries of the week. For me,
it's a really target-rich environment this week. But go ahead, you go.
It is always a target-rich environment. I wouldn't say I have jackassery exhaustion. I'm not near that yet. But it really is incredible. So this week for me, it was the appointment or the nomination. Well, it's not even clear it's a nomination. I guess it's an acting appointment of Bill Pulte, who had been the head of the Federal Housing Agency as the acting director of the Office of National Intelligence. Now, according to the law, I gather, you're supposed to have some sort of intelligence background. He has zip, none. I think Marco Rubio was on the Hill and was asked about, you know, had you ever heard of the guy before in connection with intelligence? He had to allow us how he had. And of course, Rubio had been the chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. But what he apparently has is that he's something of a bulldozer. And Trump, I think, has already indicated he wants him to fire lots of people. Why exactly is not clear. I suppose the only good news in this is it's highly unlikely that he will get, if nominated, that he'll get confirmed. I mean, a bunch of Republican senators have already indicated that this will be an uphill slog at best, but actually it probably wouldn't go through. It's also not clear to me what authorities he has, because, and if I can just go on a little rant about this, the position of Director of National Intelligence and that office, which is now mushroomed, I think, to a bureaucracy of over 1,000 people, was created in reaction to 9/11. The problem I always had with the creation of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence was nobody ever explained why if you had had this, you wouldn't have had 9/11. It was just something that, you know, seemed like a suggestion. And I've always thought that there's a good chance that all this does is create another competing bureaucracy. You know, in theory, the idea was that this lets the CIA concentrate on analysis and on espionage without having the kind of overall view of the intelligence community that the director of central intelligence is supposed to have. But I always thought, but that's kind of bogus because as it's worked out, the head of CIA has been the more powerful position. So, But I guess to get back to the main thing, once again, Trump is appointing somebody who's completely clueless about what they're supposed to do. This seems to be, once again, very political and destructive. And it is a piece of jackassery.
Yeah. And it's so often the case in the jackassery that we, you know, identify, you know, there's an element of humor in it, but there's also a you know, very serious underside here. I mean, as you point out, it's destructive. I mean, if he's not nominated and is acting, he will be limited to, I think, 180 days. But there's a lot of damage that could be done in that period of time. Moreover, there's an immediate damage, which is that the Congress has to reauthorize the Section 702 FISA authority that has been very important in counterterrorism investigations. It's always a bit controversial because there are a lot of Republican libertarians like Rand Paul who don't want to support this thing. But, you know, no Democrat is going to vote for this now, with Bill Pulte in a position to, you know, use it in all sorts of nefarious ways. I mean, the argument against the 702 authority is that it could be abused and misused. And so now they're putting that in jeopardy. Well, I have some, you know, breaking, you know, news jackassery, which is it's the season for marking up the National Defense Authorization Bill. And the House Armed Services Committee was engaged in that today. And they accepted an amendment from Ronnie Jackson, former physician to the president, who said he could live for 200 years. And he offered an amendment saying we should formally change the name of the Department of Defense to the Department of War. And it passed by a slender 2-vote majority out of the committee. Now, whether it gets through the entire House and whether it then can make it through the Senate, you know, remains to be seen. I have my doubts, but that is undoubtedly jackassery. I mean, I could go on. I mean, there's the issue, which is maybe more serious than jackassery. Because he's won the award so many weeks, you know, Pete Hegseth, we can't really let him off the hook. But his you know, taking Unitarianism off the list of approved religions for the Department of Defense.
I hadn't seen that one.
Yeah, he did that. But also he, you know, he's blocked now a list of Air Force general officer nominations or promotions. And apparently, according to the press reporting, the people he wants kicked off the list are all people of color and women. And this is now, I mean, call me crazy, but he's done it with the Navy, the Army, the Marine Corps, and now the Air Force. I don't know. I would say that's a pattern. And, you know, it's just, frankly, blatant racism and misogyny and damaging, I think, very damaging, you know, to the long-term health of the uniform military in the United States. So it's I think worse than jackassery. You know, it's really, you know, a criminal.
You know, I completely agree with that. By no means a fan of diversity, equity, and inclusion as it played out in the Obama and Biden years. But the truth is, you do want a diverse officer corps. You want one that's drawn from women as well as men, and that's drawn from various ethnic and religious groups. Homogeneity is not a good thing. It really isn't. And particularly in a military which is going to be composed of women as well as men and of many different racial and ethnic groups. But what makes it intolerable, I think, is there's not even a pretense that this is for cause. This is just, it's just, like, as you say, bigotry and misogyny. And, you know, the one question I think we'll have to ask is what's the nature of the long-term damage? One, you know, I've been talking, I think you've been talking as well, to serving officers. And I think particularly those who are women, you know, they're noticing, and it gives them pause. The other thing that really troubles me here is, you know, there's a pattern here of he will try to pick generals who are sycophantic, I think. Yeah.
Right. And willing to carry out potentially illegal orders.
Right. And you and I both have a great deal of admiration for the United States military. We have a lot of close friends who are in the military, both senior officers and further down. But I think we also know that, you know, you get the full spectrum of human beings in the general officer corps, the same you do as in the rest of humanity. And I used to think, okay, there won't be any lasting damage from this. I am not so sure. At the bare minimum, I think, and maybe this is a subject we should talk about next year, you know, the question has to be, what would you recommend to restore some sort of normalcy, or to restore, I should say, just a very high standard of apolitical professionalism in the officer corps after the damage that's been done by this man?
Yeah, and the trickiness is, you know, that holding people to account for what's been done, you know, it is, you know, you run the risk. There are two risks here. On the one hand, if you don't hold people accountable, you know, the norm is really badly damaged. If you do hold people accountable, you run the risk of pendulum swings, and that this becomes, you know, a kind of quadrennial or every 8 year, you know, event where the officer and which I think breeds cynicism in the officer corps. So it's going to be devilishly difficult to undo the damage. I was talking to a retired senior officer yesterday who I was privileged to spend the day with. And this officer was saying that they had been in touch with a lot of 06s, that's colonels, colonel level folks, who were kind of asking a question, do I want to stick around for this? And, you know, you've heard me rail for several weeks about the loss of folks in the Foreign Service. 2,000 Foreign Service officers have been riffed or resigned or retired or fired. And, you know, the point I've made, and this 06s is the same thing, sort of, you know, our generation's aged out, but the generation that you and me as taxpayers have invested money in to assume positions of higher authority in the system, their payoff comes in the age 50 to 65. And if you lose that, there's no way you can compensate for that. You can't, you know, you can't replenish that by promoting, you know, more junior people up because they just lack the experience and knowledge.
So let me, I'd offer two thoughts. I mean, I do think holding people to account is an extremely important thing to do. Although I also think that it's going to be important not to be vengeful because, as you say, then you end up in a cycle of tit for tat. But I think there are two other things. One is I'm a great believer in lustration. You know, that you even if you're not punishing people, that you say, this is exactly what happened. This is exactly what people did. This is a matter of public record. And it's, you know, usually better if it's in, you know, a whole bunch of physical red bound volumes that will be sitting on shelves. But that in any case, that there's a permanent record which you publicize saying, this is what they did and this is the damage that it caused.
Yeah. Who collaborated with the, you know, with the secret police?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is how, you know, I think the Czechs, for example, right, you know, most people believe they did the best job of it.
Right. I was the deputy chief of mission at the embassy in Prague when lustration was going on.
I think that's one thing. You're right. You're never going to get back that orderly progression. So it does mean you are going to have to, either you're going to have to bring people back from the outside when they've been doing other things, which some people may be willing to do, but most probably won't. But you are going to have to promote younger people fast. And there I would just, I mean, I just don't know what the alternative is going to be. There I would say the important thing to do is going to be mindful of it. And it may require that you change some of the things that you require. So the one example that I would think of is General Shai Meyer was a very capable chief of staff of the Army. He really did help reshape it after Vietnam. To his credit, this was a Jimmy Carter decision. I believe he was promoted over something like 43 other generals. Now, there's a problem, and I think he would have said it would have been better if he had more experience. But okay. But I think the key thing is going to be to political, and this will be a task, I believe, for political leadership, is to be really selective and say, yeah, there are going to be a bunch of people that we're going to promote. We're going to promote them early without the kind of experience we would have had in the past. And we'll take those risks, but we're going to really try to be very smart about it.
We should probably move on to some other news of the day. What do you make of where we are on the, you know, endless ceasefire negotiations in Iran? Because I know you've been on the move today and you may not have, you know, caught up with all of the, you know, news. So the president, according to the Wall Street Journal, has told associates that he does not want to go back to kinetic activity unless the Iranians kill Americans.
Right. I saw that.
But we're very close, he says. Of course, he said this, you know, for several weeks, to an agreement. The issues seem to be turning on how much of a commitment he can get up front from the Iranians about what they're willing to negotiate on the nuclear stuff, particularly the issue of downblending or diluting somehow the HEU stockpile that they still physically in Iran, even if they don't have easy access to it at this point. Again, recent news, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner are headed to Tennessee or maybe in Tennessee already to meet with DOE experts at Oak Ridge to talk about uranium enrichment. I mean, since they've been involved in this negotiation for over a year, one wonders why it is that only now they're talking to the experts, but it is what it is. Anyway, over to you. What do you make of all this?
So a couple of things. One, you know, there's been a running minor difference of opinion between us. I continue to be struck by the fact that Trump has not chickened out. And that
he hadn't gone back to war yet either.
Well, I knew you would say that, but the point is he has not chickened out. They don't seem to have yet been willing to accept tolls or Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz. I actually, in many ways, think the Strait of Hormuz issue is actually more salient than the nuclear issue, because
totally agree.
You can come back on the nuclear, and they haven't caved on that or succumbed to gold-plated Trump toll booths. Point one. Point two. Very interesting. My former boss, Condi Rice, had a piece in the Wall Street Journal, which it was, I would say, generally supportive of the administration's policy. But it the main thing was she was making the argument for the tough line on Iran. And I thought it was actually a very coherent and cogent argument. It was interesting that she chose this time to write it. I don't know if maybe she was getting... could be she was getting a feeling that they were going wobbly. I don't know why she wrote it then. But it is striking to me that she was making that case. The third thing, though, which I thought was the most interesting, there were a number of articles, including, I think, from an Obama economic advisor, saying, you know what? Markets adjust. And yes, the semi-closure or the closure of the strait is causing distress. It is not collapsing the global economy. It's certainly not collapsing the American economy. That's for sure. I mean, I can just tell you, we're now in an area where there are a lot of vacationers. Yes, it's not quite $5 a gallon gasoline. It's not stopping anybody from traveling that I can see. But more importantly, it looks as if it's not having the damaging effects that people at first thought. And people are beginning to do things like first reducing energy consumption, tapping into reserves, building more pipelines, expanding production in those countries, and there are a number, not just the United States, but also places like Brazil, expanding where people have spare capacity. And, this was this typical kind of economist argument, but I think in this case, right, that people respond to incentives. So I'm now more inclined to think this standoff could continue for some time. Very last thing I would say, you continue to get these rumors, who knows, about the internal disputes within the Iranian regime, to include difference of opinion between President Pezeshkian and the Revolutionary Guard Corps generals. I fully believe that, because one thing that's been missing throughout this debate, it seems to me, is people having any kind of realistic sense of what Iran is going through. And, that does at some point matter. So that's where we are. I mean, I expect that this is a story that you and I are going to continue to talk about for quite some time.
Yeah, I president said this could go on to September. Market immediately dropped when he said that, And then he said, but we're very close to a deal. So
here's a different way of thinking about that, Eric. I say this as somebody who is not yet a retiree, but is kind of sliding down that slope, and therefore is always looking at my retirement accounts. He's been very successful in preventing the stock market from crashing.
That's his superpower. That's his superpower, manipulating markets. I mean, he's been doing it for a long time.
That's a pejorative way of putting it,
but it's also true.
It is true, but in this case, he's manipulating markets in a good way.
Look, I have a slightly – look, I take your points about – and I saw the pieces on, people switching to electric vehicles and, the market – energy markets are more resilient and, than they were, say, in 1979. That's undoubtedly true. On the other hand, our former colleague Bob McNally from Bush 43 – has talked about the fact that we haven't really hit the wall yet because so many people had built up such large reserves. Economic activity was somewhat down before all of this started anyway, so consumption hadn't been that high, and that we're likely to hit a point where we really will be stretched and supply will start to be short. So we haven't kind of gotten to that point yet. My understanding is the White House, that he's been in the White House and has briefed them. So they know this too. So, I take your point on differences inside the Iranian regime. I'm more struck by the, plethora of articles that are talking about the differences inside the Trump administration, including, Rubio and Vance and others. So, this is, I suppose, a little bit of a glass half empty, glass half full argument, but I do think, we can't make a judgment until we see what kind of agreement comes out of this. But I think we're probably getting pretty close to when we will get an agreement. I do think we'll get something in the next couple of weeks. I mean, the one issue which we should talk briefly about that's hanging over this also is Lebanon. That was the occasion for the Iranians to declare that they weren't going to abide by a ceasefire as long as Bibi wasn't abiding by one in Lebanon. And my sense of it is now that Bibi's had his arm twisted by the president into a ceasefire with the government of Lebanon, which isn't really the relevant actor because it's
right. Control over Hezbollah.
Right. But it does appear that something's going on with Hezbollah that Bibi's insisting that he wants a buffer zone, but he's not talking about staying where Israeli forces are now. Nobby Berry, the head of the Amal movement, the Speaker of the Parliament, and probably the most prominent non-Hezbollah Shia politician in Lebanon, said he supports, and I think this is kind of a tell of where Hezbollah is, he supports Hezbollah withdrawing north if Israel withdraws from Lebanon. Now, I think he meant all out, you know, he wants them back behind the blue line. And I think it's more likely they're just going to withdraw down to the Latani and stay kind of there. But I think, you know, to paraphrase George Bernard Shaw, they've kind of agreed what each of them are, and now they're just haggling over the price.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the question is the larger significance. And I think the larger significance is Iran is determined to hang on to Hezbollah as a proxy. I think Hezbollah... The problem with, I think, outfits like Hezbollah is it's not as if they have political objectives the way I think we would usually think of them. I mean, for them, resistance is the objective. And, you know, they fight. They are because they fight. And they fight because they are. And that, you know, that as if you're trying to think about a strategy for dealing with people like that, then I think you have a problem. Could we move on a little bit to Europe? I just wanted to share with you the conversation with – it crystallized something that I've now been having an impression that I've been having from conversations with a number of Europeans who are personally friendly. I mean, this is not personal animus. But the suspicion and hostility, I would say, to the United States – is well beyond anything that I think, certainly I've ever experienced in my lifetime. I mean, even people who, you know, really hated George W. Bush and all that, it's in a different place. And it's a combination both of, you know, we think that we think you're stupid, that, you know, that's always been there. What you have now is something that you may be a potentially hostile power. And that's how we have to think. Not that you won't show up, not that you'll be indifferent to us, not that you'll be doing something foolish, but that you may well be hostile to us. But the other part of it, which I think gets underplayed in this conversation, it came out, is we don't really think we can have confidence in your constitutional order. It echoes things that my more left-wing friends, you know, periodically say, and I usually poo-poo it, saying, I don't think there's going to be another presidential election, or I think Trump will somehow try to violate the Constitution and run again, or, you know, I think that's overblown. And this is a very, very serious individual I was speaking with, and a very knowledgeable one, and I tried to talk him out of that tree, and I failed totally. So I don't know, are you having similar conversations with European friends and colleagues?
Yes, and I would characterize it slightly differently. I don't think it's hostility to the United States, although there is hostility towards Trump and the Trump administration, for sure. I think it's more anger and a lot of disappointment in the United States, more than anything. And who can blame them? I mean, you know, this week... You know, the thing that crystallized this, I think, was the threat the president made against Greenland.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That gets brought up.
Yeah. And from the European point of view, it's totally understandable. Denmark has been a model ally. They've lost more people per capita in Afghanistan than we did. I mean, I remember having conversations with, you know, Søren Gade, the very, very good Danish defense minister when I was in government, who was a tremendous partner and a tremendous ally. And Donald Trump threatened to invade Danish territory, essentially. And, you know, they took it very seriously. They moved forces there. I mean, and just this week, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, a national security advisor, was asked about Greenland and said, it's Denmark's, right? And he said, yes, for now. I mean, so, you know, opening up again the prospect that, and Trump has been, apparently people around Trump have been talking about this again, Trump has been, you know, again talking about Canada as the 51st state. You can say that it's not serious and it's trolling, but I think, you know, completely understandable in my view from where they sit. And then just one last thing, Elliot, I would say. It's fine for us to say our constitutional procedures are very robust. You know, it can't happen here, which, as I recall, was, you know, the title of a novel I'm sure no one is taught to read in high school anymore. Europeans have their own experience with authoritarianism and fascism, and some of it very recent. You know, so from where they sit, looking at this, again, I can understand why they are not certain at all about how this will all turn out.
I think that's right. The difficulties with that, which this is the, you know, some of the arguments I try to make, and I always stipulate, you're completely right, you're completely justified. And I really do believe that on all the points that we've been discussing. First, you should try to distinguish between this administration and the country.
Yeah,
And it's not even, you know, the MAGA movement and the country. It really is this administration. I mean, if you look at the basic polling attitudes, they haven't changed nearly as much as people think. And I say to my European friends, and I think you run a risk of, you know, if you keep on telling people like me, you know, we hate you, we mistrust you, we think you're out to get us, you know, at some point you go, okay, fine. You know, if you can't distinguish between Donald Trump and me, or people like me, then there's a problem. So I think that's one thing. Second is they've usually failed to contextualize it in it two ways. One is that, you know, some of this eruption is in the context of very longstanding American frustrations with Europeans and their ability to defend themselves and all that. It doesn't excuse any of it, but it is an important part of the context. And I think one has to acknowledge it. But there's another context, which is in Europe, as in the United States, you have these populist movements. And this is part of a larger troubling set of developments, I believe, in advanced Western societies.
I agree, and I accept all that. I would say, because I know you're going to France soon, you know, I hope you have some of these conversations with some of our, you know, more sophisticated and nuanced French friends. Because I will tell you, I recall in the spring of 2016 going to France and having French colleagues and friends express their misgivings about Donald Trump. And I, you know, they said they're very afraid of Trump becoming president. And I said, yeah, I am too. I said, but, you know, why are you so concerned about it? And it wasn't so much NATO as the, you know, the feeling that he had some kind of Russian influence or Russian connections that were troubling, because they know that the Russians have been trying to suborn their political class, and that if the United States wasn't there to, you know, lean against that, it could have very powerful impact in Europe in a way that would be very dangerous and damaging. And of course, I think some of that has actually sort of come to pass. So, again, you know, I think, of course, one would hope that they can make the distinction between, you know, the nation and the current administration. And I think, you know, most of the serious people do. But in the context of not only threats to invade allies, but this constant drumbeat of, we're not going to send the Dark Eagle missile to Europe, we're pulling a brigade out of Germany, we're canceling a rotational deployment to Poland. Oh, wait, no, maybe we'll let it go, but who knows, we could cancel it again. And now we're not going to sell you missiles that the U.S. promised to sell Germany because we're afraid it's going to annoy or, you know, aggravate the Russians. I mean, I think what you see is what you're going to get.
I think that's right. Well, I will report back. I'll be seeing actually quite a few French officials and experts, some of whom are longstanding friends of ours, some of whom I'll be meeting for the first time. You know, I think the French are more used to having their doubts about the United States. So it's not, you know, for other European states, I think particularly for the Nordic states.
Yeah.
This is a shocker.
Yes.
For the French, it's, yeah, I mean, this is very bad, but what do you expect of the Americans? We should probably move on to some other things.
While we're on Europe, let's talk about, President Putin's, economic conference, his St. Petersburg Economic Forum, which is sort of meant to be a kind of Russian answer to Davos. And it had a sort of explosive opening.
Yeah. I mean, a huge pillar of smoke as the Ukrainians hit it. Candace Owens still showed up to shill for the Russians, which I suppose tells you something. I think one thing that's going on right now is there does seem to be this larger consensus that the Ukrainians have the upper hand for the moment, that the Russians are not only taking these casualties, but they're not actually able to cash in that much on the Iran war because, you know, their own oil industry is getting so badly battered. This had to have been enormously humiliating for Putin that he's having this meeting in St. Petersburg, and it struck in a visible way. You know, one of the things about hitting oil storage depots or refineries or what have you is there's usually a spectacular fireball and then a really big pillar of smoke. So everybody knows that what just happened wasn't a car engine backfiring nearby. It was something else. And there continues to be this very interesting pattern where people who are supportive of the regime are nonetheless critical of it and saying, you know, we can't go on forever. The economy's in worse shape than we think. And they're usually careful to phrase it in such a way that they won't fall out of a 10th-story window. But you do wonder if the signs are beginning to be there that at some point Putin's going to wake up and not be in charge, or perhaps not wake up. I know you're more of a Russia expert than me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess first I think it's really worth spending a moment on the casualty numbers just because they're so astonishing. And I know we talk about it from time to time, but the head of MI6, I think it was, said this past week that British intelligence assessments are that the Russians have suffered 500,000 killed in action and a total number of casualties of 1.3 million. I mean, this is not quite World War II numbers for the Russians. They're World War II numbers for us, but not necessarily for the Russians.
It's beyond what we lost in World War II. Or to think of it differently, it's about eight times the deaths, just the deaths that we took in Vietnam. Eight times that, from a smaller population base.
Right, because the Russian population base is considerably smaller than the USSR's was. He also got a bunch of bad economic news. You know, the war's costing a lot more than they forecast. I mean, it's really blowing a hole in the Russian government budget. He hasn't really had all the benefit he might have hoped to get out of higher oil prices, in part because of the Ukrainian deep strike campaign. Ukrainians' sort of mid-range strike campaign going after Russian logistics has been very successful. So he's had bad news on the battlefield. His response, however, as best I can tell, has been, you know, big missile barrages aimed at Kiev. He doesn't seem – I don't see any signs that he's close to relenting yet. So I'm afraid we're going to be in this for a while longer. Now, if we had a normal administration, right, what would be the logical strategic position for the United States to take? It would be to lean into this with everything we have.
Our kind of administration would do that. I'm not sure.
Well, President Reagan, as I quoted when we were talking about Andy Marshall and in Basin Harbor, and I mentioned the economic briefing he gave to President Reagan in 1986, where he basically said, can't go on like this. Something has to give. Russians Soviets can't continue to bear this military burden that they're carrying because the economy is not doing well and has no prospect of improving. And President Reagan said, so the message I take from this, I need to keep my foot on the gas, pressuring the Russians, which is my instinct to begin with. That's what ought to be happening here. I don't think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Although, I have to say that I'm struck by what I'm not seeing. What I'm not seeing, or at least what I'm not hearing, is the absence of American aid to Ukraine as opposed to arms sales and intelligence cooperation, which continue, having a really deleterious effect. There was also there was an interesting thing, which is I did the House pass a Ukraine aid package, which is an interesting thing, given that that's not what the administration wants. And it's one of a number of indications that I think Congress is finally beginning to indicate that it may buck Trump on a few things. You were going to say a few words about North Korea, and then I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about what we've been reading these days.
I'm happy to do that. So we promised listeners a while back, after Victor Cha's article on foreign affairs appeared on North Korea, that we would talk about North Korea. And there have been some developments, I think, that are somewhat interesting. First, Kim Jong-un has been boasting about how much more fissile material North Korea is producing. And I think we're likely to see in the not too distant future that the North Korean nuclear arsenal will get close, if not outstrip, that of some of our allies who are nuclear weapons powers, like the French and the UK. They'll probably breach where the Brits are, even though the Brits did increase the size of their arsenal a little bit a couple of years ago. But secondly, they put something in the North Korean constitution, which is that in light of all the decapitation strikes we've seen in the last couple of years, the Israeli decapitation of Hezbollah, the U.S. kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro, the U.S.-Israeli decapitation strike that took out the supreme leader in Iran, that in light of that, it's now a requirement of the North Korean constitution that if something happens to the supreme leader that's untoward, there will be a North Korean nuclear strike on the United States. Now, that's a pretty serious issue. Now, the thing that Victor Cha suggested in his foreign affairs article is that the North Star, of our negotiating position with North Korea since the Clinton administration has been to denuclearize North Korea. And we reached an agreement during Bush 41 in September. Our former colleague, Chris Hill, the special envoy for Korea, North Korea, a former ambassador to South Korea, and Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs, got agreement with the North Koreans as part of the six-party talks that the objective would be complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization in the acronym crazy world of government, CVID. And Victor was suggesting CVID is no longer attainable. And he had a whole bunch of recommendations of how we might, you know, approach North Korea, you know, or manage the problem, I think is the best way to put it. I found Victor's, you know, comments about why denuclearization is probably not in the cards pretty persuasive. I must say I found the recommendations a little bit more weak, you know, kind of weak tea, but I don't know. What do you make of all that?
Well, I mean, it's one of these things that we've been watching unfold for quite some time. And, but I, in a way, we've all kind of wanted to close our eyes and pretend that it's not going to happen. When I, by it, I mean not just North Korea having a few nuclear weapons, but having a very sophisticated nuclear arsenal. And that is, that for me, the scary part is that seems to be in the cards with a rather diverse array of nuclear weapons and delivery systems, including the ability to hit the United States. The decapitation issue has been on the table for a while because I believe the South Korean military developed a decapitation operational concept. But I think there's a broader issue here, which is we and some others, the Israelis chiefly, but also the Russians, you know, we've been the ones doing the decapitating. And the assumption has always been, well, other people don't get to do that. And I don't see why that should be the case. And sure. For sure, I will tell you one thing. If the Iranian regime continues to exist, there is no doubt in my mind that they will try to kill Trump, maybe Hegseth, various Israelis, General Kane. I mean, they're going to be under the gun. And that's just something we have to be prepared for. Well, this is all very depressing stuff. The good news is that you and I continue to broaden our educations and read widely and deeply. Let's talk nonfiction.
I have gone back to read an old classic, and I've done it in part because of, you know, all the hoo-ha over, you know, how we treat the history of enslavement in the United States, which is, you know, kind of America's original sin, if you will. And I went back and read something that I had not read since I was an undergraduate, actually, which is Kenneth Stamp's book, The Peculiar Institution, which was a kind of effort to write a synoptic history of the institution of chattel slavery in the United States. It was written in the 1950s, and it was written in response to the so-called revisionist school of Civil War history, Avery Craven, William Dunning, other American historians of the South, who basically were arguing that the Civil War was actually not about slavery and that slavery actually wasn't such a terrible institution anyway. He wrote and that Reconstruction was a horrible period in which terrible people imposed, you know, awful things on the South, you know, carpetbaggers from the North, unprincipled scalawags, unprincipled locals who went, you know, who joined in on this, that it was a period of unprecedented, you know, graft and peculation in Southern history, and that illiterate and incompetent African Americans were put into office. Stamp also wrote a very important book in a couple of years later called The Era of Reconstruction, which actually put, you know, began to put to bed a lot of those myths. But Peculiar Institution is a really powerful book when you read it because it makes it clear just how awful enslavement in the United States was as an institution, and how lucky we were that providentially a leader would come along who was able to lead the country through the war that ended it.
There was a volume in the, I think, the Oxford History of the United States, this big multi-volume history by Richard White, and I'm blocking on the name for the moment, but it really rams home how horrible Reconstruction was. I mean, in terms of the number of African Americans who got murdered, but also, you know, people came down from the North to help. Although what's interesting is, you know, when Grant became president, he really did try to crack down on it. And Phil Sheridan, quite a ferocious cavalry commander, did a good job of breaking the Klan. Our minds run along parallel tracks here. I just finally finished, this is a reading project I've had for months now, Alan Nevin's History of the United States from 1846 to 1865.
I'm looking on my shelf and seeing 2, 4, 6, 8, all 8 volumes.
Eight volumes. So I've also had it on my shelf forever, and I said, well, by golly, I had to try to read it. And it is a wonderful historical work. So Nevin's was, I think, one of the last professors who didn't have a PhD, started off as a journalist. A gifted writer, and I thought there are many wonderful things about the series. Part of it is that he really does all the different kinds of history quite well. That is to say, there's political history, there's social history, there's economic history, there's military history, and, you know, he's writing in the age of great generalists, and you really came away with a sense of what the power of that is. Secondly, he brings together both the sense of the tremendous potential of the United States, the kind of exuberance, if you will, the growth, but also, you know, the intractable problem of slavery. I think I detect a difference between the early volumes and the later volumes. I think his views shifted over time, and he's much harsher on slavery when he's writing in the 60s than he was in the 40s. Like Stamp, he brings out the varied nature of the institution. Slavery is horrible, full stop. Slavery in the northern southern states was very different from what it was on the plantations of Mississippi and Alabama, where it was, you know, beyond hideous. He shows the difficulties in the way of really trying to come to a peaceful resolution. I mean, I have to say, at the end of the 8 volumes, I just don't see how you could get through this without a really big war.
That's why William Henry Seward called it the irrepressible conflict.
That's absolutely right. He also, I think, brings home in a way that even these histories of the 1870s that I've read, the way in which the victory of the North in the end, it represented a number of things. Lincoln's genius, the abilities of people like Grant and Sherman and Sheridan, but also just the extraordinary organizational capacity of the North and the way in which you begin to have really big, sophisticated, complex organizations of a kind that we now take for granted. So even things like, for example, the Sanitary Commission. When the war begins, there's really almost no serious provision for medical care, certainly not on the scale that's needed for soldiers. By the end of the war, there really is. I mean, it's 19th century medicine, so I mean there are limits there, but it's still on an enormous scale and tremendously impressive.
Same with logistics, right? Same with modern logistics.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you read accounts of what the Siege of Petersburg at the end and the south of Richmond is like, they're just massive bakeries. You know, they are keeping the Union soldiers at the end of the war are well fed. And they're eating, you know, they've got canned vegetables, for example. And the contrast with the South, which just didn't have that for a bunch of reasons, was really striking to me. The last thought I had just on that is, I'm sure Alan Nevin's is somebody nobody reads anymore, and he would probably not get tenure in a major history department, and historians would look down their nose on that kind of vast, sweeping history, which is narrative, but also somewhat analytic. But if anybody has the patience for it, I would commend it to them.
So, you know, it's interesting because Stamp also wrote extremely well, and The Peculiar Institution was not published by a university press. It was published by Knopf. And it sold reasonably well to a general public. And, you know, I agree with you about Nevins. First of all, he writes beautifully. And he and Henry Steele Commager wrote jointly a narrative history of the United States, again, beautifully written, that, you know, a lot of us read when we were in high school, back in the, 50s and 60s, which is no longer read. I mean, it's just not. And all of these books, it's interesting because these were books that were, kind of book of the month club selections and, back in the day. Some of them made the bestseller list. I mean, Bruce Catton's histories of the Civil War were all bestsellers. And it's old style narrative history. And, you and I were bemoaning the decline of enrollments in history departments. But I think the fact that academic historians have moved away from that kind of narrative writing is one reason why they've lost market share. I think it's actually a shame for the country. I mean, I also read recently that those kinds of books today are considered, since we're approaching Father's Day, dad books.
Yeah, right.
And I won't say they're in disrepute, but basically in the publishing industry, maybe we don't want to publish that.
That's right. So the only glimmer of light in that is Library of America just published Bruce Catton's books on the Army of the Potomac. And they're a very good read. They're introduced by Gary Gallagher, who's a very formidable historian. And there are people like our friend Will Hitchcock, who are terrific writers. We'll get him on. One other thing about Nevins also is he wrote a book called Pathways to History, which is one of these books about how to think about history and how to study history and how to do history, and which are intrinsically very interesting. I think somebody who was probably at Yale when you were there was Robin Winks, The Historian as Detective, which is a wonderful, wonderful book. And those are the books which I think drew a lot of people into the study of history. And I think at this juncture in our history, the lack of that kind of interest in history and sophistication about how to think about it, that's a serious lack. And it is part of the story of how our politics has become so kind of disoriented. I think you just have a lot of people, including politicians, who don't know how to think straight about the past.
And therefore they're clueless about the present.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Robin was a wonderful person, a great historian, great scholar. Unfortunately, when I was at Yale, I never studied with Robin, but I was a grader for him for his, one of his exams. So he was really wonderful.
I hope you did not give 85% A's the way Yale does now.
I was a real bastard then. I've mellowed somewhat since then, but,
Yeah.
What are you reading? Are you reading any fiction right now?
Yeah, so partly on vacation, I've begun reading Terry Pratchett, British author who died too young. Terrible disease, but it was extraordinarily prolific. And it's this kind of, I wouldn't say gonzo fantasy, but that's sort of what it is.
Yes.
The Discworld books, which
are totally fabulous.
Hilariously funny.
Very funny.
They're sort of send-ups. Part of them are send-ups of Lord of the Rings and that sort of literature, which I...
And Macbeth and everything else.
And everything else. I mean, these are all things which I really like. So initially I kind of bristled at that. But as he says, he's basically just writing about human nature. And I think, it's important. the really good kinds of fantasy fiction. Actually, you know, part of what makes them effective is they are talking about human nature. They're just doing it in this kind of crazily refracted way. What about you? What are you? What fiction are you reading?
So, you know, since you mentioned Robin Winks, and nobody writes espionage fiction, you know, like our British friends. And I've been kind of oscillating between reading in sequence Mick Herron's Slow Horses series. So a few weeks ago, I finished Dead Lions, which is the second, having read Slow Horses earlier. I'm working my way through that, but I'm interspersing it with Dame Stella Rimington's Liz Carlisle novels, which are, she was the former head of MI5, first woman to be the head of MI5. And so she's writing about an internal security service and a character who I mean, far be it from me to be a, you know, amateur psychologist, but seems to me based probably largely on herself. And they're very, very well done. She writes they're, you know, compulsively readable and very topical. I mean, this was set, I think it was written about 10 years ago, but it was set in Britain around the time of the various Al-Qaeda attacks on Britain in 2005. So it's about jihadis trying to bring weapons into Britain with, you know, scummy arms traders. It's, you know, full of all kinds of great stuff. But particularly good, though, on the on some of the tradecraft of, you know, of the Internal Security Service and surveillance teams and CCTV cameras and, you know, people hacking into people's emails. It's really great stuff.